The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, September 12, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The 15th anniversary of 9/11 passed yesterday with remembrances and ceremonies, reflections on the attack, 15 years of combating terrorism since, and also concerns over the health of Hillary Clinton, who left a memorial service at Ground Zero here in New York, looking wobbly, even passing out before she got in a van. Later in the day, her doctor said that Clinton had been diagnosed with pneumonia on Friday and told to rest. She didn't rest, and, well, the nation saw the result. Hillary Clinton has now canceled campaign trips for the next couple of days. We'll have more on the evolving history of presidential health and health disclosure coming up. Meanwhile, during those remembrances and during these elections, the hard practicality of Middle East geopolitics plays out beyond American borders. Secretary of State John Kerry announced that the United States and Russia came to an agreement for a hopeful ceasefire in Syria that is supposed to go into effect today. Now, both the U.S. and Russia have agreed to join forces against Islamic jihadists in Syria, where that civil war has raged for 5 years, displacing millions of people. This is part of a new plan that will require a 7-day ceasefire in Aleppo and other besieged areas. David Sanger is national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times.
It sounds less than a full ceasefire. The main thing is it's supposed to last for 7 consecutive days before the next part of the plan kicks in. So that means genuine reduction of violence and humanitarian access into Aleppo and other besieged areas. Then after that moment, the United States and Russia begin working on targeting specific al-Nusra and Islamic State targets. They've already got their maps together. This shouldn't take them very long. And at the moment that they start attacking those, Assad's planes are supposed to stay completely grounded. They are not supposed to be attacking anything other than the Islamic State. And even that is going to be highly discouraged. The idea here is to keep Assad from bombing civilians under the pretense that he's just going after al-Nusra, which was the weakness of the last system.
And it seems, David, like the basic idea of this plan is to sort of get some of the sides in this morass separated so that the Russians and the Americans can focus fire on their common enemies.
That's right. And that means disentangling the opposition groups the United States has been supporting from al-Nusra. They are frequently, in a lot of cities, including in Aleppo, marbled in. Now, sometimes they're marbled in because they like each other, and sometimes they're marbled in because they can't stand each other and they've been battling among themselves. And that's essentially the big weakness of any of these plans. You know, it seems when you first look at the headlines that this is more like something from the Cold War. The United States and Russia come together and reach an agreement. The difficulty is that there are so many other parties here, Iranians and their Shiite fighters, the Saudis, many other opposition groups, some of which the United States supports and some which we do not.
And is this supposed to help solve the problem from the American perspective of the Russians claiming to go after ISIS targets when, in fact, they've been bombing factions on the ground that are friendly to American interests?
Well, that's what the joint targeting is all about. At the same time, the Pentagon has opposed this joint targeting provision because they're afraid it teaches the Russians too much about how the United States identifies and executes against targets. So, of course, you've got a Pentagon that's dealing with Russia in much more hostile ways in many other parts of the world, and they're having a hard time getting their head around cooperating with them in this particular case. But Secretary Kerry, you have to give him credit, persevered on this and won that argument in the White House on the basis that anything you could do to keep Syrians from getting killed was worth doing.
And so if this does work, though, David, it might keep Assad away from civilians for a while. That's the hope. The bottom line for the U.S. is partly that and partly targeting ISIS effectively. Are they targetable even if this agreement works? Can they be significantly weakened from the air by this combination of Russian and American air power?
I think they could be because they're on the run as it is. They've lost a lot of territory, as you've seen. They don't have any real air defenses of any kind. The question is, what do you do when they reabsorb back into dense population areas where you simply won't want to target them from the air? And we have heard President Obama and both candidates for president say they don't want to put in ground troops. So there is only so much you can do from the air. But as you've seen, the ISIS territory, at least, is shrinking. That doesn't mean the ISIS problem is shrinking.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks again.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, Hillary Clinton has been diagnosed with pneumonia by her doctor. She left a 9/11 memorial ceremony early on Sunday here in New York, looking wobbly as she got into a van. At 68 and 70 years old, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are among the oldest people to run for president in recent years. This is far from the first time that candidate health has been a campaign issue. Donald Trump's campaign has been active in stoking conspiracy theories about Hillary Clinton's health. Now she's had a real-life health episode, and that has raised the volume on the debate about candidates' health disclosure. Mark Siegel is an internist in New York City and a clinical professor of medicine at NYU School of Medicine and a medical correspondent for Fox News. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal on Sunday calling for more transparency in candidates' medical records, and he joins me now. Dr. Siegel, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. Good to be here.
Should the Clinton campaign have disclosed on Friday, in your view, as soon as they knew that Hillary Clinton had this diagnosis, or was it only an issue once it became an issue?
Todd, I'm a big believer in transparency and disclosure. I understand what campaigns are going through because they want to make sure that information isn't distorted. But let me tell you what the problem is. It's that if you have a vacuum of information, guess what? Pundits and even physicians tend to fill that vacuum. They tend to speculate. They tend to say, and this was going on all day Sunday, it could be this, it could be that. Maybe it's severe, maybe it isn't. But that's doing the public a disservice because the public here has a right to know about the health of candidates for president of the United States. That's especially true now in the age of information. Before, many generations ago, and I wrote about this in my Wall Street Journal op-ed today, you know, generations ago, we had things going on like Woodrow Wilson having a stroke in office. Nobody knew about it. We didn't like it, but can imagine how that would feel now. Same with FDR, same with JFK. So I think we're at a time when we believe in knowing the information and having transparency and having full disclosure. So I'm sensitive to the idea that campaigns are concerned about how this will be perceived, but I'm all about the more information, the sooner the better.
How much medical information do you feel you got from the letter from Donald Trump's gastroenterologist proclaiming him the healthiest person to ever be potentially elected president?
I'm troubled by the letter from Donald Trump's physician. I believe that, you know, he certainly appears on a video to be healthy. But look, that's part of the problem. I don't think diagnoses should be made or diagnostic impressions or speculations on video. He is 70 years old. I think we should have his full health records, that he should release his full health records as well. You know, we're seeing things like his blood pressure is good, his prostate examination blood test is good, but his lipids are supposedly good, and we know that he's on medication for that. I want full disclosure. I want full records on the part of both candidates because I believe that in 2008, we set a standard with Senator McCain. We said, look, he had a melanoma history. He's over the age of 70 years old. We want to see his full records, at least for a limited viewing. Now, we have two candidates. Donald Trump is 70 years old. Hillary Clinton is 68, but has significant health history. I'd like to see the full health records released by both candidates.
So indeed, back in 2004, though, George W. Bush and John Kerry both released full medical records or something close to that. They both released like 400 pages of records that were reviewed. And you write that since then, there's been this steady slide in the amount of disclosure from candidates across the board.
Well, President Bush did reveal his full health records. With Senator Kerry, it was a little bit less than that. There was some question about his war records. But yes, he ultimately released records. You know, Senator Bob Dole, when he was running in 1996 as the oldest candidate at the time, was under pressure and released full records. I think it had become a trend to release health records. And then there was a pushback in the other direction until 2008. When, in fact, Senator McCain released his full records for a limited viewing of journalists and physicians in Arizona, and I was lucky enough to attend that, I thought that that the new standard had been set at that point, that in 2008 we set a new standard. Now, 2012, we had two candidates. President Obama was youthful. We at least seen a letter from him, and we weren't pushing for as much because he was younger and he appeared to be in very good condition. Also, Mitt Romney released some records. I believe that now we're seeing an aberration. What we're seeing is not sufficient. I think the public has a right to full disclosure, and I think given the age of the candidates and the health history of at least one of the candidates, we should be seeing a lot more, and I think the past we did see a lot more.
Mark Siegel is an internist and a clinical professor of medicine at NYU School of Medicine. He's an analyst on Fox News, and he joined us to help us out with the history of medical disclosure presidential candidates. Dr. Siegel, thank you.
Todd, thank you for having me on today. I really appreciate it.
So here's a story that brought two documentarians out of retirement.
It was a mugshot of someone I didn't recognize who lived in my town, who was approximately my daughter's age. His name was Teray Moses. I wondered if my daughter knew him. In fact, she did. She'd gone through middle school with him. And she remembered him as a good student. He was well-liked and had also been president of the school at one point.
But this was a mugshot. I mean, he wasn't getting an award here.
Right. I wanted to go behind the mugshot. I wondered what was behind that mugshot. Who was this person? And I understood that he was from a troubled background and that teachers had rallied behind him. At that point, I got in touch with Dan Gill, one of the teachers, who remembered Teray as a very bright student, as inquisitive as anyone he'd ever met, and he imagined that someday he'd go to Harvard, perhaps. But by eighth grade, Dan wondered if, in fact, he'd end up in prison.
Steve, did you respond to this by saying, oh, here we go again, another story. I'm done with TV.
Well, I had started teaching. John had retired. And we saw this as an opportunity to do something without a budget, without a timetable, without bosses breathing over our necks. We can do the film that we want to do. But we really didn't know we had a film until we went to that prison and interviewed him.
That's John Hockenberry speaking to John Block and Steve McCarthy. They're co-producers of The One That Got Away. It's the story of Teray Moses, who in 2010, at the age of 20, was sentenced to 15 years in New Jersey State Prison for murder. They tell the story from the perspective of those who were close to Moses, including a group of teachers who understood both his promise and the tragedy of his life. The film premieres tonight at 9:30 p.m. Eastern on WNET. That's America's flagship PBS station here in New York. You can find it anywhere online at WNET.org. And later this hour, we're going to have a conversation with Teray Moses' teacher, Dan Gill. So we've been asking you, how would you improve your local school district? For Medford, Oregon, abolish all aspects of Common Core curriculum 100%, returning American education back to the basics. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always leave a comment at the website at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The NFL officially kicked off the season last Thursday with a close rematch between the 2016 Super Bowl teams. Of course, there was a full slate of NFL games on Sunday. Tonight will be the first Monday Night Football traditional doubleheader. But the league continues to struggle with concerns about concussion-related brain trauma to players. Take a listen to this from the first game of the season, Carolina Panthers versus the Denver Broncos.
The flag is thrown. Shaquille Barrett put the heat on. Newton writhing on the ground.
Oh, it's a shot to the head, too.
Yep, helmet to helmet.
That audio courtesy of NBC, but you heard it there. Helmet to helmet. Carolina quarterback Cam Newton took several hits to the head during that game, including a last one which was ruled an illegal hit. And even after that, Cam Newton stayed in the game. Now, a few years ago, in response to public pressure over concussions and long-term health effects on players, the league put in a new system. NFL games now have one concussion spotter who sits in the booth above the field and two unaffiliated neuro trauma consultants for every game. They're supposed to stop a player from playing if they suspect a possible concussion during play. Now, the league says that the new protocols have been effective, but are they? And will they lead to healthier players in retirement? Chris Nowinski is co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation. Chris, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
This system of spotters, concussion spotters, or eye-in-the-sky spotters, how does it work?
Well, there's a trained athletic trainer up in the skybox with the television feed with binoculars who has the ability to call down to the sideline and have the medical team remove a player who has shown concussion signs.
What can you tell from a distance when this spotter sees something? What are they looking for and what can they really discern from where they are?
Well, this started because there were some very obvious concussions that were missed by the sideline staff, the kind of things where a player stays on the field holding their head in pain, or where a player stands up and then loses their balance. Balance is sometimes impaired with concussion and usually is a very obvious sign. And those are the most common things you can see, you know, from that far away.
So a concussion, though, doesn't have to be from a hard head-wrenching hit, right, necessarily? I mean, there can be a series of softer hits or one hard hit followed by softer hits. This is not just a question of head-banging collisions that cause concussion.
No, I wouldn't say it's often a number of smaller hits. Certainly, you have the concussions usually caused by rapid head movement, which doesn't involve a direct blow to the head, but it could involve a whiplash type of movement. But certainly, it is one hard hit that's going to trigger the injury.
So the eye in the sky calls down to the sideline, says, "I think Jones is showing signs of a concussion." What happens on the sideline under league rules or under team protocols? They get Jones off the field, and then what?
What happens is they need to determine, you know, whether or not they want to do a partial evaluation or a full evaluation, and that is sort of can sometimes trip them up. But a full evaluation would take about 8 to 10 minutes. It would involve the team doctor. It would involve what's called a UNC or unaffiliated neurotrauma consultant, so an independent doctor on the sideline who participates and observes as per the collective bargaining agreement with the NFL. And both of those doctors need to feel comfortable putting that player back in, or otherwise they will hold them out if they do find signs of a concussion.
So both of those doctors have to concur that this player is fit to play. If one overrules the other, the player can't go back on the field?
Correct.
So this part of the system, we talked about the eye in the sky spotters, this part of sideline review, is it helping the players?
It is helping the players. I mean, the weak spots that you see in a case like Cam Newton is, you know, what you call a sign of concussion. So Cam Newton takes a severe blow to the head. He gets hit. He doesn't get back up for a few seconds. He gets onto his hands and his knees and looks like he's in pain. To me, that triggers a concussion evaluation, but that may not meet the criteria that the current spotters are using. And then the second hole in the process is, the medical team did say a couple days later that they did talk to Cam Newton during the 2 minutes and 22 seconds that the game was stopped, but that they didn't perform a full evaluation. And so therefore, what you can accomplish in 2 minutes when you're not really using any tests is, how do you feel? If the player says fine, they can go back in. So there's still gaps that are going to allow players with concussion or a player with delayed symptoms of a concussion to remain in the game and expose themselves to injury.
And are you satisfied that the unaffiliated neurotrauma consultant, the second consultant on the sideline that you mentioned, is truly independent and isn't under any kind of perverse incentive to satisfy the teams that he or she is working for?
Well, they aren't working for the teams, and that's really the idea of having the UNC, the independent doctor, is that they're chosen by both the NFL Players Association and the NFL. And so they are really meant, they're about as independent as you can get. They get somebody who they trust in their training to understand sports concussion, but they're not, you know, there's no money involved. There's not really high prestige involved. We really do hope the players are getting the best care in that situation.
And so one of the problems, though, Chris Nowinski, is that none of this changes the very nature of the game at the NFL level, right? Very, very big men colliding very, very hard with each other, with their heads. There's better review, there's better evaluation, but it doesn't really change the nature of what's going on in the field.
Correct. What it's solving is the ethical problem of us seeing clearly brain damaged players being put back in the harm's way against what would be considered proper medical guidelines. So we all feel better now about watching the games. It doesn't necessarily change these terrible outcomes that we're worried about for football players. It's not necessary. We don't know if it's going to change outcomes with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. If we catch a few more concussions, we don't know how many cases of post-concussion syndrome we're preventing. So it's it's the right thing to do, and we absolutely should be focusing on this on game day. But it sort of distracts from the bigger problem that we're diagnosing these former football players, and not just NFL players, with this degenerative brain disease, CTE.
So, Chris Nowinski, we all feel better watching these games, but how long is it going to take before a scientific review can actually tell us whether these rules, these new procedures, are improving the health of retired athletes, preventing CTE, and preventing compromised health of players years after they've left?
Yeah, we won't know that answer for decades, unfortunately. We still can't diagnose CTE in living people, so we can't take a baseline measurement of athletes' health now and see what happens in the future. So the reality is we need to invest a lot more energy and money into understanding these long-term problems because they are, CTE is really a destructive disease, and we don't have our arms around it yet.
Chris Nowinski, co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. The Obama administration made an unprecedented announcement on Friday when it temporarily blocked the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. The pipeline has been at the center of months of protest and lawsuits. The administration's announcement came just minutes after a federal judge denied the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's request for an injunction on the pipeline's construction. The tribe had claimed that the pipeline would destroy sacred sites and could pollute drinking water. Now, when the administration stepped in, it gave the tribe a temporary victory, but the pipeline's future is now uncertain. Joining us to discuss the impact of this announcement is Jim Grijalva. He's professor of law at the University of North Dakota and director of the Tribal Environmental Law Project. Jim, welcome.
Hello, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
Well, a federal judge declined to stop the pipeline before the weekend, then immediately the Obama administration stepped in and halted it for now. Where do things stand?
The pipeline contractors have been directed to cease construction on both sides of the highway that was sort of the epicenter of the lawsuit, both to the west and the east of the potential crossing of Lake Oahe. And that means for the moment, everybody's trying to figure out what the next steps are. There's definitely interest at the national level in a larger conversation. But as it relates specifically to this pipeline, I think we're in somewhat of a limbo, both on the development side and on the tribal side, about what next steps are with respect to the environmental review of the pipeline proposal.
Still, most of this pipeline's construction is on private land, right? So how can the administration step in and block this?
Well, one of the confusing and complicated aspects of a project like this, Todd, is it's so big that it crosses so many jurisdictions. And so there's overlapping federal and state jurisdiction and different states involved, which makes it a complicated issue. The Corps of Engineers, the federal agency that's at point here, has jurisdiction essentially over the crossings of navigable waters and other certain waters, and doesn't have jurisdiction over the so-called uplands areas. That's where the states decide whether to permit or not. And so the pipeline company is in this awkward situation of having to get permission from multitude of state and federal agencies. And most of the permissions have been granted on the upland sections in North Dakota and I believe in the other states. But where there are significant water crossings like the lake, the Corps of Engineers has jurisdiction to agree or to decline the permit or to condition the permit on environmental and cultural resource reviews.
And this is a pipeline that's supposed to run all the way from northern North Dakota down to refineries in Illinois. So, you know, if we're about to change administrations one way or the other, how do the tribes who've had this temporary victory here view this decision? Because the next president, whoever that is, could change it, drop it, sort of ignore it? There seems to be some limbo here.
There's always the question on any particular issue of what will be the next president's stand and the administration's perspective. The Obama administration has been fairly positive with respect to engaging tribes and trying to treat tribes in the government-to-government relation that's been the nation's policy since about the 1970s, and trying to engage them as it does states and other significant governmental stakeholders when there are large projects proposed. So the question, of course, is whether the next president will continue that approach and continue to try to ensure protection of tribal resources, tribal lands, and also the treaty rights and cultural resources that are outside of what lawyers call Indian country, which includes reservations, but also some other areas. So as you know, a lot of the continent is formerly tribal or indigenous lands, but as a result of contact, a number of those lands have been shrunk. So the Standing Rock tribe has a smaller reservation than its traditional ancestral land. And so some of the lands outside the reservation have potentially significant cultural resources that the tribe continues to want to protect.
The Obama administration blocking construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline after months of protest. Jim Grijalva, professor of law at the University of North Dakota. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Todd.
This week, our partners at Retro Report take a look back at the defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment.
In almost every Congress since 1923, there has been proposed a constitutional amendment to guarantee equal rights for women. Well, today, it finally won approval.
Proclaiming once and for all that women have all the same rights as that other sex.
The agreement now goes to the states and must be ratified by 38 of them.
When those news reports aired in the spring of 1972, the Equal Rights Amendment was on a path to ratification. The ERA had broad support across both parties. It would have prohibited deprivation of equality of rights by the federal or state government on account of sex. That's what the ERA said. But the ERA drew a lot of criticism from religious groups and social conservatives who feared it would diminish women's traditional roles, embolden what they called the homosexual agenda, and lead to increased abortion. That movement against the ERA was led by activist and Eagle Forum founder Phyllis Schlafly, who died last week and was eulogized by Donald Trump over the weekend. Well, the ERA was defeated, but much of its purpose has since been realized, and it's also led to a major realignment within American political parties that has lasted to this day. Kathleen Hughes is a producer for Retro Report.
There are people who feel that the ERA would put in the foundations of our constitutional law once and for all equal rights for women. And they worry that until we have it there, the laws and that have been passed in the intervening years can always be undone. But it's much, much more difficult to undo a constitutional amendment.
So this has always been a fight about women's rights. But some of the side effects of this long battle really echo in today, and they're fascinating. I mean, explain how the ERA helped distill the political parties into ideological camps, conservatives to the GOP and liberals to the Democratic Party, because it was not always so.
No, it wasn't. I think what happened was Phyllis Schlafly very craftily, very cunningly broadened the conversation. She started talking about women's roles. She started talking about how men would no longer be responsible for their wives and raise the specter of divorce and women being left in the street.
One of the first things that the Equal Rights Amendment would do is to invalidate the state laws that make it the obligation of the husband to support his wife. I get fed up with the women's liberationists running down motherhood and saying that it's a menial, degrading career and that the home is a prison from which women should be liberated and brought out into this wonderful workforce.
That led to conversations about abortion. Then suddenly, you know, it was abortion, it was homosexuality, it was a sexless society. All of this stuff was brand new back then. If you look at what happened at the 1980 convention, you see a huge change in the Republican Party. You really see it turning to the right. With Phyllis Schlafly looking on, the party took out its support for the Equal Rights Amendment from its platform. At the same time, it put in an anti-abortion platform.
Meanwhile, that social conservatism of the Republican Party of Reagan, the 80s and the 90s, has gone by the wayside in so many ways with Donald Trump ascending to the top of that party for this election. And one of Phyllis Schlafly's last acts was to endorse Donald Trump as a true conservative. It's remarkable because it's almost impossible to imagine the Phyllis Schlafly of the 70s making that endorsement, you know, for a man with five children by three women, famous Playboy reputation, literally on the cover of Playboy, who was pro-choice before he was allegedly pro-life.
Exactly. She saw him as some kind of disruptor, I guess. I tried to get her to talk about that when I interviewed her last May. What she said several times was that he's a true conservative underneath it all, that she didn't love everything about Ronald Reagan when she threw her support behind Ronald Reagan, but then he eventually, quote, came around. And I think she saw that Donald Trump would come around to a lot of the conservative positions as well.
So the ERA was defeated. Phyllis Schlafly won the battle. But here we are in 2016, looking back. So many of these parts of the ERA, as we've said, are now taken for granted. And Hillary Clinton leading the Democratic Party. And you've contrasted the battle and the war here.
Exactly. When I started talking about this story I was working on, so many younger women said to me, oh, I thought we had the ERA already. You mean we never passed it? There's an assumption that women these days do have equal rights to men. In the Constitution, technically, it seems as though we don't.
The history of the Equal Rights Amendment, the career, the life and the death of Phyllis Schlafly, all included in the new Retro Report. Kathleen Hughes is the producer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples. With copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom framed prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples. Make more happen.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Dan Gill has been a teacher in New Jersey for more than 40 years. His story and that of a former student, Trey Moses, now serving 15 years for murder, is featured in a new documentary called The One That Got Away. Now, Gill told John Hockenberry that Trey's fate still haunts him, but it doesn't stop him. If anything, it pushes him back into the classroom and to building relationships with his students.
I think the biggest thing about teaching is building relationships. And the biggest thing that any teacher needs to do before they begin to teach whatever it is that they've been assigned to teach is to begin to understand who that student is that sits before them and try to assess what are the ways in which they learn, what are the things that are preventing them from achieving, what are the things that they do well, what are their weaknesses, and who are they as real people, so that you can begin to relate to them in a way that they'll begin to understand that you're teaching not a subject, but you're teaching them.
Earlier this hour, we heard the voice of Teray,
right,
who was in prison. And you can hear both that he's a kid, but you can also right. hear that he is in prison. Give me a sense of that Teray, who was the kid you right. saw.
Teray was one of those kids who you would always want as a student because he was inquisitive. He didn't just accept the lesson. He wanted to extend the lesson. And he did so in a very positive way that helped other students learn. So this was the kid that sat in front of us, and we were just in awe of that enthusiasm and that curiosity.
Teray Moses lived in two worlds, and
right.
one of them was your classroom,
mm-hmm.
and one of them was the world that he knew.
Mm-hmm.
Here he is talking about that world in the film.
A lot of guys locked up now, they know me. They don't even know what I look like now, but they know me ever since I was little because I was a little baby walking on the streets with my mother and her friends. They were doing drugs, and it's all I ever seen.
How much were you aware of the disadvantages that Teray Moses came from?
We were very aware early on about his challenges. One of his challenges was the fact that his father, who was his guardian at that time, would never sign a permission slip to go on a trip. That's a real challenge because the classroom is one thing, but for kids like Teray, they need to be outside the classroom into places where we can take them and so that they can absorb more information. So there was one challenge. The second challenge was he used to tell me all the time, and I stay late at school because of kids like him because they have very little after school and there's no program for them. And he would say, Mr. Gill, do I have to go home? I really don't want to go home. And it used to really affect me greatly when I would have to say, no, I have to go now. And then the third thing we knew is that he was hungry. He was hungry all the time. A colleague of mine used to bring him lunch each and every day because he didn't have that kind of a home life where that he received that sort of support.
Here's what Shelton White, Teray Moses' father, said right. when finally confronted by John Block about why he seemed to be not involved in Ture's success at school.
I wasn't that kind of a parent. I'm not coming to the game. I'm not doing that. That's not me. I'm going to hit the streets. I'm going to take care of my business. I'm going to take care of my son and keep him straight. But y'all, I don't have nothing to do with you.
What was your response when you heard that?
That's who he was back then, and I'm sure that's who he is today. That's exactly what our frustration was. We couldn't even reach him on the phone. It was very, very difficult.
What did Ture believe was possible for him? What did you believe was possible for him? And when did you know that it was slipping away?
Our science teacher, Miss Blank at that time, her name is now Mrs. Noto, she said, okay, he can be a leader. And so she was in charge of the student council at that time. So what she decided to do is to encourage him to be participant in the student council. And then in seventh grade, at the end of seventh grade, they have the election for the president of the school for the next academic year. She encouraged him to do that because she felt that that leadership was going to provide for him an opportunity to explore those areas that we knew that he was capable of doing.
Did he win?
Yeah, he wins by a landslide.
Oh, my God.
And the funny part of the story is that he's got all the what you would call like the nerdy kids like working on his campaign, and they're writing his campaign speeches and whatever, and, you know, they're trying to guide him, you know, to
this
victory.
Is the guy.
And the funny thing is he gets up to make the speech in front of the student body, and he throws the papers away, and he just talks.
Good morning. I'm Ture, the student council president, as you all should know, and I'm making a speech.
He just says what's on his mind, and that's like it took over the whole student body. He wins, and then what happens is that's where the eighth grade comes in, where it starts to deteriorate. He begins to get into trouble. It's minor at first, and that kind of spirals out of control. He gets in so much trouble he has to go to juvie. His father doesn't come to get him, and he spends 2 weeks in juvie, and I don't think he was ever the same after that.
It's easy for me to say, there's no way to overcome something like that.
Yeah.
What do you say?
Each of us in our own lives who teach believe that we are able to meet those challenges. And yes, practically speaking, you cannot actually reach each and every child in a way that you would like to. But you don't give up, and you never say no. And you do everything in your power, if you really truly believe in what you do, is to help kids like that find their dream and to find the place where they rightfully belong in our society and not to be underserved. And the one thing about this film that I think is important is that it's not emblematic of what I did or the other teachers you see in the film. I think what hopefully people walk away with is the understanding of how many teachers do this sort of work each and every day beyond the scope of what their responsibilities are. Our profession has taken quite a hit lately about what we don't do. But I would say that if you look at that film, you're going to see the face of so many people who do so many things to help young people. And even though he's in jail today, I now have sitting in front of me students who are just like him. And I'm not going to let this opportunity pass by.
Dan Gill, social studies teacher at Glenfield Middle School in Montclair, New Jersey. Thank you so much, Dan.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's Dan Gill speaking with John Hockenberry. The One That Got Away premieres tonight at 9:30 p.m. Eastern on WNET Channel 13 in New York. You can find it anywhere online at WNET.org. And it is back to school season. We've been asking you, how would you improve your local school district?
This is Stephanie from Sussex County, New Jersey, and that is no small question. First, I would fire the Federal Control Center. Then I would put a stop to unfunded mandates. These steps would repave the way for local control. Then I would sit back and watch the parents and other relevant stakeholders dismantle the high-stakes testing mechanisms. Hey, then I would double the time allotted for recess and ban homework before the fifth grade.
From Anoka, Minnesota, more funding for STEM classes, non-abstinence-only sex education, and shop class. We got this from Fort Worth, Texas. Teachers should be paid more. Paying more would allow for a higher standard of education and discipline. all teachers should also know about basic behavior principles designed to help them better control a classroom with age-appropriate reinforcement and punishment. We want your take, of course, at 8778-MY-TAKE. That's the number. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. And you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. It's a great way for you to keep up on the news on your commute. So get in touch with us there. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.